The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. I'm so pleased to see such a wonderful turnout. I'm George Day, and I'm here to celebrate three things. First and foremost, I want to celebrate this fabulous library. You saw an aspect of it in the video, and it really is a major instrument for bringing literacy, inspiring curiosity throughout the city of Philadelphia. So I wish to invite you to think about supporting us as we go forward and move into, I think, a major new era and an exciting era with great leadership. The second celebration is a memory of Bobby Glanday. And the lecture is appropriately named the Memorial, obviously, but it's also important that it was set up to almost model Anna Quinlan. Bobby was a civic activist, a tireless worker on many, many boards. Many women that I have met would say that she was one of the people that really did crack the glass ceiling in Philadelphia. So a major leader, an inspiring woman, and a great admirer of Anna Quinlan. Now, the third celebration is that she is here for the sixth time. And that, I think, is a wonderful testament both to her productivity and to her roots, of which I'll say a little bit more. So a little bit of background, and I think the timing is very interesting. At least I found it fascinating. She worked from 1981 to 1994 writing her column, Public and Private, for the New York Times, which really looked at world events through the eyes of a woman, a mother, and a wife. Which was, I think, a powerful but extraordinarily common sense way to look at world events. And so she had a great capacity to reach people. And I was an enormous fan, and I think many of you were, where I would read Anna Quinlan's column and say, wow, that's what I was thinking, but she put it into words. And the Pulitzer Committee obviously agreed. She received the Pulitzer Prize for Commentary in 1992. She left journalism in 1995 to write novels, five of which are bestsellers, and we all have our favorites. One in particular, it's one of my favorites, One True Thing with Meryl Streep. But her ability, I think, what she sets apart in many different ways, as you're going to hear shortly, but she has this ability to capture the beauty and the fragility of family life. And that's what we're going to see in her new novel, Still Life with Breadcrumbs. It's a very appealing, and I found it a hopeful novel. And what I took away from it was that it's really never too late to embrace life's second chance. And so it's a great pleasure for me to bring her back again. Now, the reason that I use back again is that she was born in Philadelphia. So she truly is coming back again. And so please, a rousing, warm welcome on a cold night. Anna? Thank you.
Well, good evening. This is my sixth time at the Free Library, but the first time I've been here in the evening, so they let me out at night this time. And it's always a pleasure to be back in Philadelphia, the city where I was born and which I still love so much. So I'm in this wonderful library tonight, and it gave me an obvious peg for what to discuss with all of you. So let's look at the cover of this. What is that? It's a phrase. Not really. Words? Not precisely. Characters. No, not a base. Look at this the way a 3-year-old would. This is nothing. This is lines and circles and dots and a series of black marks that, taken alone in a vacuum, mean absolutely nothing. It's nothing. It's also a complete and utter miracle, because everyone in this room knows what that says. I wrote those words in my office in New York several years ago, and years later, many of you might read it in your home or are looking at it in this hall tonight. I invented a woman named Rebecca Winter, discovered that she was a photographer, lived alongside of her as she left New York City, a little defeated, very short on cash, to move to a rented cabin in the middle of nowhere to save money to seek inspiration. I met the people that she met there. I heard them talk to her, and I heard her reply. It's a strange, strange life we novelists live. We make terrible dinner party guests, because when we're doing it right, we're creating a wholly fictional world that, to be honest, comes to seem more real to us than the real world in which we live. I wanted to start by sharing with you a short section from the beginning of this world before we get started. It's a moment when Rebecca, who is a city girl through and through, has discovered that the cabin she's rented has someone living in the attic crawl space. The roofer had returned at 8 a.m. She had already been up for hours. The roofer had looked as though he had too, but in a good way. Damp, fair hair like a cornfield with its comb tracks. T-shirt with a hint of fold marks and the smell of fabric softener. Dark green windbreaker with the words Bates Roofing in gold embroidery. He must have a good wife, Rebecca had thought, picturing a woman folding his T-shirts, smoothing them with her hand, handing him the windbreaker from a hook in the hall. The rented house reeked of smells Rebecca preferred not to parse too closely, and from time to time there was a half-hearted clanging noise from above. She wondered if the raccoon would die of exertion. She hoped so. She had heard the staccato drumming of the truck engine climbing the hill, and she went out front, where the air was fresh and lovely, grass and flowers and a suggestion of wet soil. Why did the forest out back smell of rot and the sunny front lawn like the signature scent of springtime? A glint of light crossed her face from below, like some mysterious signal, and she raised her hand to shade her eyes, and the roofer raised his to return what he clearly thought was a greeting. I don't even need to ask, the roofer had said when he got out of the truck, although she wasn't sure if he meant the circles under her eyes or the smell from the house. How on earth will you get that creature out of the attic? She said wearily. First the coon, then the cage, he said, and from the passenger seat of the car he took a long gun. You're going to shoot it? Unless you had another idea, he'd said. When I saw the trap, I assumed you would release it. He held the gun by the barrel. It was carved with a hunting scene, a man and a deer, both stiff and unconvincing, but made beautiful by the gloss of the wood and the faint blur to the figures and the finish that Rebecca thought meant the gun was old and well used. Grandfather, father, son, a family gun. Here's the thing about raccoons. They're creatures of habit. If you catch a coon and spray paint an X on his butt, then let him go, a week later you'll be catching the same coon. The X on his butt will be laughing at you. So yeah, if you want, I can let him go, but unless I drive him to Maine, he'll be back and trying to find a way into your attic. You'll be starting all over again. Rebecca closed her eyes. No, thank you, she said. Good decision, he said, opening the flimsy screen door. Sometimes I think city people wind up watching too many Disney films. They confuse real animals with cartoon animals. Can I take a look first, she asked, at the coon? I'm a photographer, she said. Be my guest. She'd climbed the ladder in the narrow hallway, thrust her head and shoulders through the hatch, and rested her elbows on the edge of the filthy attic floor. The cage was wedged into the corner over the kitchen, up against a pile of old screens and a cardboard box. The raccoon looked over its shoulder at her, its pinpoint eyes wild with fear and rage. It did look like a cartoon character, but a cartoon character in one of those avant-garde cartoons young artists were always making and Ben was always praising. Sven the Possessed Raccoon, it would be called. She thought she heard a hiss. An overhead bulb in the center of the triangular space cast deep shadows. The scent of waste and desperation was too much to take for long. She shot a few fast photographs as the coon hurtled toward her, clinging to the bars of the cage and somersaulting as though he could spin free. He stopped not far from the hatch, and she shot a few more of his pointed face in close-up. He ate the banana, she said after she came down the ladder. I think that's a she, the roofer said. A male raccoon is pretty mellow. He'd probably be half asleep right now. A female raccoon will tear you to pieces if you give her half a chance. So, the roofer, the raccoon, Rebecca, they're here, right? Because the real miracle isn't what happens when we write. It's when we writers meet you readers. You come to live in the world we create if we're lucky. To join us there. I mean, centuries after they came to life in the imaginations of Tolstoy and Dickens, we still unravel alongside Anna Karenina and learn the lessons Scrooge does when he meets with those ghosts on Christmas Eve. How is it possible that 200 years after Jane Austen finished the manuscript in secret, putting a blotter paper over it whenever anybody entered the room, we come to Pride and Prejudice as if it's a brand new thing? It really is a miracle. We read in bed because reading is halfway between life and dreaming. It's our own consciousness in someone else's mind. E.B. Huey once said, to completely analyze what we do when we read would almost be the acme of psychologists' achievements. For it would be to describe very many of the most intricate workings of the human mind. I've spent some of the best years of my life trying to analyze what we do when we read, because I really believe with all my heart that reading made me what I am today. It made me a better writer, a better citizen, and a better mother. There's no question that it made me choose the profession in which I find myself, although I had help. I was born in 1952, a time when a wild and curious little girl didn't have a whole lot of venues for her dreams, even dreams as formless as mine were. I lived in Drexel Hill, in a neighborhood in which all the fathers worked and none of the mothers did, in a world in which all the power and influence was held by men. Women athletes, women jurists, women editors, women secretaries of state, women rabbis, even a whiff of a woman president, all of those things were far in the future. So the question was, what kind of life were we going to imagine for ourselves? Those girls who felt as though the parameters of our lives were as narrow and circumscribed as the dollhouses people were always giving us as gifts. Our mothers really couldn't help us. Our teachers sometimes served as examples of one of the only lines of work to which we might aspire. But the librarians recognized us. Maybe it occurs to me now, they had once been us. And they decided that their seditious answer to those dollhouses would be the printed word. Books are very dangerous things. This building is dangerous because it offers unlimited possibilities. The Greek word for I read also means I recognize, and that's so perfect. I never even met anyone who was Jewish before I read The Diary of a Young Girl by Anne Frank. And to suddenly discover that there was an entire class of human beings of which I was completely ignorant, but that others wanted to wipe off the face of the earth was really in some ways the beginning of my true education. Those were the kind of books the librarians handed to girls like me. Those girls with skeptical faces and a dangerous glint in our eyes. Books about other girls like us. Anne of Green Gables, Betsy and Tacy, The Girl of the Limberlost. And the biographies, too. Molly Pitcher, Betsy Ross, Florence Nightingale. But there was about those biographies a kind of second-ratedness. Women who did all the things that were corollaries to the real work. I didn't want to sew a flag. I wanted to wave one. So one day, that school librarian gave me a book about Elizabeth I, the redheaded Tudor queen of England who once said, I have the heart of a man and I am not afraid of anything. I know so much about Elizabeth I. Although I moved on once I began to realize that I would probably find myself incapable of world domination. But I think that same librarian began to recognize me not simply as a dissatisfied girl, but as a nascent writer, as someone who wanted to do battle with the world, but was going to do it with simile and metaphor and alliteration. And I know that she understood that I was going to be as lost for models in that world as I was in the larger one, and that she needed to provide me not with entertainment alone, but with aspiration and inspiration and the sense not that women could be accepted as writers, but that they could be important as writers. And so she turned me toward adult fiction. As George Eliot wrote in Adam Bede of Another Young Woman, Hetty had never read a novel. How then could she find a shape for her expectations? One of the stories that I like to tell about my reading life is about being in eighth grade and going to take the scholarship test for a convent boarding school. And the essay question beginning with this quotation, "It is a far, far better thing that I have done than I will ever do. It is a far, far better rest that I have gone to than I have ever known." Afterwards, we had tuna fish salad and chocolate milk at long tables in the refectory, and all the other girls around me were talking about what the quote meant and where the quote was from and what you could write about that quote, and I was pretty sure at that moment that I had won the scholarship. I mean, how many times had I already gone up the steps to the guillotine as Sidney Carton went to that far, far better rest at the end of A Tale of Two Cities? It never seemed to a book like me, but like a place I had lived, I had visited, and I would visit again, which is exactly the way I feel about the places that I create in my own novels. You feel as though they are more real than the real people, you know. I grew up in a lovely, lovely place then and now, but I really lived within the covers of books, and they were truer to me than any other thing in my life. That's why I wanted to be a writer. When I was 11 years old, I went to the library to try to figure out where my book would land on the shelves. It was between Proust and Ayn Rand. Now, at this moment, it's important that I stop for a necessary digression confession. I love reading. I hate to write. I have to force myself every day to sit down and begin. This is the first thing I always tell students who have bought into the peculiar American notion that if you are good at something, you must find it effortless and pleasurable. Sometimes they ask how I continue if I hate to write, and I reply glibly, because of contractual obligation. But I really only manage because I live a very humdrum life in which the drama takes place almost entirely on the page unless the dog eats something really bad. Every day begins with a period of mindless and repetitive activity. My one-hour power walk is nominally cardio, but it's actually composition. I'm thinking of scenes and characters and even dialogue. I know there are people in Riverside Park who think I'm a lunatic because sometimes I think I move my lips. But one of the reasons I so fear the overscheduling of today's children is because the truth is that most creative thought happens when you are staring into the middle distance, looking like you're not doing anything at all. And if you don't leave that space for people, they don't develop the ability. Inspiration hardly ever arrives. I think she's at Toni Morrison's house. I take a lot of pleasure in this quote from Madeleine Langla, who wrote A Wrinkle in Time, one of the best books ever. Inspiration usually comes during work rather than before it. So for that to happen, you have to sit down in a chair. I don't really believe in writer's block. It's not that sometimes you can't write. It's that you think that you can't write well. Well, you know what? Bad writing, gonna happen. But experience has told me that writing poorly sometimes leads to something better. Not writing at all leads only to reruns of Law and Order, which are great, but still. Also, when I'm writing a novel, I have a totem that helps me fall back into its world. I had an old Hasselblad lens on my desk while I was writing Still Life with Breadcrumbs. While I was writing Blessings, I had an old Hamilton wristwatch with a sepia face that I could imagine on Lydia Blessing's wrist. Stephen Sondheim always says that it's his utensils that are unvarying. He uses black wing pencils and yellow legal pads with precisely 32 lines, which are both so essential that he has laid in this huge lifetime supply. On the other hand, I need Sondheim in the background while I write. It's not so much the music as the familiarity of it, like wallpaper in the workroom of my imagination. And my schedule is set to music. I've heard these endless stories of young people rising at 5 a.m., to fit in a few hours writing before they have to go to work or the kids get up. But I can't even make coffee at 5 a.m. My productive hours are between 9 and 3, which is an elementary school schedule, in case you didn't notice, which was once the only predictable part of my day unless one of the kids got an ear infection and then all bets were off. And even though they're not kids anymore, I stick to the schedule. If I go out for lunch and interrupt, Eudora Welty once said, fiction has and must keep a private address. She said, to interrupt is only to lose. If I go out for lunch and interrupt, I'm sunk for the day. I think all those lunches were what did Truman Capote's output in. Or maybe it's that he talked too much about his work. I always tell my son Christopher, who's a YA author and is always saying, so then there's these three kids and they're on an island. I say, if you talk it, you won't write it. It's as though the words turn into vapor in the air. And if you write other stuff, you won't write it either. One of my Barnard writing professors, B.J. Shute, used to tell us not to take any job that included writing of any kind because there was no chance that you would end the day and then go home and take up your own material. But she predated the internet, which is much more dangerous than any copywriting gig. I'm convinced that there's only so many words per day in the human body. If you do some longish emails, you feel like you're done. Finally, for me at least, how I start each day depends on how I finish the day before. I never knock off at the end of a chapter. I never knock off at the end of a paragraph. I never knock off at the end of a sentence. I always stop in mid-sentence. Because starting a new chapter, maybe even a new paragraph, first thing in the morning might be too much to bear, but I can always manage to finish a sentence. And one sentence has a way of following another if everything else around me is boring enough. And then eventually there's a book. And I look at my shelves. Faulkner, Edith Wharton, Jane Austen, Amy Bloom, Alice McDermott, Russell Banks, Don DeLillo. I look at my shelves and I know a book is an enormous blessing. Nothing brings people together like reading does. Nothing enables them to find points of contact, points of conflict, ways to talk about what moves them and what distresses them. We enlarge our world when we read, and we enlarge ourselves. In a democracy, it is as dangerous to cut library budgets as it is to cut the defense budget. We're always looking for reasons that reading won't survive. We're always telling ourselves we're less good than we think we are. Most recently, we talk as though technology is going to kill it. This is not true. There is some evidence that people are reading even more because of e-readers, and we now know there are lots of double dippers. People who download a book and then say, I want the real thing too. I read the New York Times digitally last night, and neither its greatness nor my understanding was diminished one iota. I remember one of my older colleagues at the Times, his typewriter planted firmly on his desk, inveighing against our new computer system in 1978. He said, "How can you write on something that makes no sound?" You can write on it just fine. You can read on it, too. I have Jane Austen on my iPad, and I think she'd get such a kick out of that. And, of course, I have multiple editions on my shelves. There are lots of reasons to be suspicious of worst-case scenarios about reading, but the best reason is because they have been disproved over and over and over again. Plato argued in the Dialogues that if ordinary people learned to read and write, poetry would disappear, because it was only in the oral tradition that poetry could be preserved properly. TV was going to kill radio. The paperback was going to wipe out the hardcover. Publishers Weekly, which is the publication that covers the industry, complained that reading was going out of style, wrote, "The movies consume so large a part of the leisure of the country that little time is left for other things." They wrote that in 1923. We are always in America saying the good old days are over. Well, if we want to make sure that the good old days are now, there's a lot we can do. To begin with, please don't complain that your kids don't read if you don't. Kids live what they learn. If you prefer The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills to prose and poetry, they will too. And we all have to be those librarians for the kids in our own lives. The individuality of kids is something we all talk about in this country, but when we provide books for children, we sometimes seem to forget all about it. The summer reading lists are filled with books that were on them when I was young, and I'm pretty old. I mean, The Island of the Blue Dolphins, terrific book, but it was on my summer reading list. Really, I don't think we can expect the boy who lives, eats, sleeps, and breathes sports to be engrossed by A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. But Jane Levy's biography of Sandy Koufax? That might make him a lifelong reader. There are so many good YA books for the kid who is feeling lost or beaten down or bullied. We have to lead kids to books that speak to their own experience. We can't be afraid to do that. Each year, the American Library Association, bless them, comes out with their banned books list for Banned Books Week. And I note yet again that if you want a pretty good list of the best books ever written, you should look at the books that are banned every year. Harry Potter, Of Mice and Men, Catcher in the Rye, Moby Dick. Books that challenge, books that frighten, books that enrage, books that do all the things a good writer wants to do, books that do all the things a young mind needs to grow. We don't bring young people to reading or to citizenship or to empathy by offering them homogenized pap. And we have to bring them to reading not just for their good, but for the good of this entire country. What words and stories do is too important. They help us imagine people, places, and events we will never see or meet. And in a society in which isolation seems to be our greatest problem, a society that is riven by geographic apartheid, reading connects us and reminds us that we are much more alike than different. Thomas Jefferson once wrote, "When the press is free and every man able to read, all is safe." I believe in pretty much untrammeled reading. I love this quote from Holbrook Jackson, "Fear of corrupting the mind of the younger generation is the loftiest form of cowardice." I gave my eldest Portnoy's Complaint when he was 13, not only because he was a really serious reader, still is, but because I didn't want him to think he was the only person in the world on terminal testosterone overload. I learned all about sex from Mary McCarthy's The Group when I was 13 years old myself. I have a paperback copy. It immediately opens to Dottie's deflowering, just like that. Well, today, as an old married mother of three adults, I can tell you that it didn't hurt me one whit. In fact, I like to believe that the seditious view of the pinched and narrow lives of educated women in that novel set me up to become both a feminist and a columnist, two things I've been very pleased to be. And in fact, the McCarthy book is important in my life because it illustrates what is the most important thing about reading in the modern world. It helps us feel less alone. Is there anything more important we can say? When we recognize ourselves in the pages of a book, when we see our own foibles and tragedies reflected as part of the usual span of the human race, it makes us feel more human. That's especially important for kids. I know this from experience. I mean, picture this little girl growing up in the suburbs of this great city, sitting in a club chair in the living room. All she wants to do is read and maybe write. She has a real mouth on her, and she hates dolls, and she's prone to wandering, loves taking the trolley, and she has this unspoken, inchoate need, which is the need for power and influence, for a voice which no woman around her has. A column, a novel, a public identity, they are all far, far in the future. And then that librarian hands her a book, and she opens Little Women. And there is the smart, strong, dissatisfied, fledgling writer Jo March. And suddenly she knows that she is not the first of her kind on the planet. And her life opens like a book and begins. Thank you very much. My helpers are here with microphones, so if any of you has a question, I'd be happy to answer questions for about 20 or 25 minutes, but you need to get the microphone in your hand first.
First, I want to thank you. I've been coming to these author presentations for many, many years here at the library, and this is the first time I've ever heard a speaker talk specifically about the importance of reading and the importance of books, and it was wonderful.
Thank you. Okay.
My question is not original to me. I actually heard someone in one of these sessions several years ago ask it of Toni Morrison. it's not a tough one. It's just curious.
And she pulled out her Nobel Prize.
When you are involved in writing a book, do you read other books?
When I'm doing the first draft of a novel, I can read anything. But there's something about because I feel like I am secure in the bedrock of that world. But there's something about revising when my security is shaken somewhat, to be honest, that makes it very No, it doesn't make it difficult. It makes it impossible for me to read literary novels because I tend to pick up people's tics. So while I'm revising, I only read mystery novels. Now, the reason I hesitate to say that now is because it makes it seem like mystery novels are a step below literary novels, and we happen to be living in a golden age of mystery novels. Kate Atkinson once said she wanted her books to sell, so she put a murder in them. And she's proved that by producing Life After Life, which is an exquisite novel that is not in any way, shape, or form a mystery novel. But you have people like Denise Mina or Laura Lippman or George Pelicanos or Tana French who are mystery novelists today who are just sublime. But for some reason, because the book seems slightly more plot-driven to me, I don't pick up what they do in the same way. So that's how my reading life sort of breaks down.
Thank you. Could you speak to your opinion as to audiobooks and whether you think that diminishes the experience or does it create more readers or folks who wouldn't have otherwise been readers? How do you come out on that?
Audiobooks are an interesting question for me because I have to put this right out there. I have never listened to one, including my own. I usually solicit, if someone tells me that they've done the audiobook of one of my novels, I always ask them how the reader did and so on and so forth. Look, I raised kids at the beginning of the height of the learning differences phenomenon. So I know that some people learn better by listening to material and others by looking at it on the page. I don't feel that it diminishes the experience. You know, it's useful for us to remember that Charles Dickens, among the greatest novelists in the history of the form, who, by the way, is well represented with material in the rare books room here, which means they're incredibly lucky, used to go to places and perform his novels. And apparently it was really something to see. So it's not my form, but I know people who really find it the most pleasing way to appreciate the texture and richness of a novel, and I have no argument with that.
We're not at middle school yet. And a three-year-old. Can you give some more specifics on how you encourage reading, especially with all the technology and the overscheduling? Can you give some specifics on how to encourage reading?
Well, the overscheduling, all I can say is under schedule. I mean, I actively did not do certain things with our kids because I really thought they needed time to dig sticks into the dirt and say, I'm so bored. I really felt like that was a pivotal experience in childhood. But I really think if you know a kid that you can find, I mean, you know, there were ample opportunities, for example, for our second son, Christopher, to be led away from books. But he was always into some creepy crawly, so he was crazy about snakes. And, of course, we had to have a snake. But I bought piles and piles of books on snakes, some of which were way outside of his comprehension range, and he eventually read them all. Ditto bats, ditto dinosaurs. Now, I mean, if I'd been trying to get him to read Bridge to Terabithia, which he did eventually read, and by the way, he is a young adult novelist now, it would have been doomed to failure at that period. So, I mean, you know, for jockey boys, there are great sports books that they can read, and that I have seen time and time again lure them away from World of Warfare or Jumpin' Monkeys or whatever the heck is on the computer screen. You know, the other is computer downtime. In your house, you can block the signal in your home. I know because writers do it all the time because they find if they don't, they spend all their time playing Words with Friends. I once had a really bad Tetris habit, and I just had to kill the program. But I think if you make a zone for reading in the day, in your house, in your life, that you can get them more inclined to read. But I think the main thing is to get books that really suit their interests and manias.
What information do we have in terms of male and female reading electronically as opposed to hardcover, fiction versus nonfiction?
They're pretty clear delineations. Women still tend to buy about 85% of all hardcover books. And women tend to disproportionately read fiction. Men tend to disproportionately read history and biography. But originally we thought digital was going to be a male preserve, that it was going to be disproportionately male. And in fact, it's not. I think the tilt now is slightly towards more women reading digitally, which may be because they don't want anybody to see that they're reading 50 Shades of Grey. And the form has been a boon for certain genres. For example, romance novels. Romance novelists tend to write, say, a book a year. Some people don't like to be seen with them, but some people also feel like they're fungible. They buy them in mass market paperbacks. They read them. They're not going to reread them. So digital has become a real home for romance novels. It's become a real home for mystery novels. So those are some of the differences we're seeing. But the differences in terms of how men read and how women read go back to when I first went on tour for the first time 25 years ago. It tends to be a fiction, nonfiction divide pretty clearly.
Do you ever miss writing a regular column, or do you prefer writing the novel?
I loved being a columnist, and I had a really good run at it, but there's kind of an on and off switch in your brain when you stop being a columnist, because you're not a columnist when you're writing your column. You're a columnist 24/7. Everything's grist for the mill. You know, there you blow into Seattle and you know, notice that they're building on the waterfront, and you blow into Toronto and notice the same thing, and suddenly the next thing you know, you're writing about how the economic downturn may not really exist because everywhere you go, they're building condos. I mean, that's a bad example, but everything becomes grist for the mill. You're thinking like a columnist all the time. And when you turn off that switch, to think like a civilian again is really restful. So, I mean, I loved being a columnist. I can't imagine doing it again. At this point, there's really, to my mind, only one solid gold place to do it, and I already did it there. I'm just going to keep on writing books, which challenge me in a way that columns don't as much anymore, because I did them for so many years that I got more comfortable with the form.
Are you concerned that our bookstores are becoming an endangered species, and what can we do about it?
Well, I assume that you're talking about independent bookstores mainly, because there's still some chains out there. But look, when I started this, there were 4,000 indies. Today, there's 2,000. Some of those went under for very sad reasons, and some of them went under for the reasons that all businesses sometimes go under, because they weren't necessarily very well run. I mean, so what I would say is that the independent bookstores where I've appeared over the years that work really hard to engage their core consumer base, that are not immediately hostile to digital, that run great events, which are really important, that do all kinds of imaginative things to bring people into the stores, those bookstores are feeling pretty good about where things are right now. Because one of the things I think we're finding about digital is that it may have topped off just a little bit. I don't mean that there aren't still many people who like to download books, but we're finding that there's this core group that really like to own them. And as I said, some double dippers who like to download and own, because then you can pass it on. I don't purchase books on Amazon. I purchase from bnn.com. That's the place where I download books, and it's the place that I buy books, because I buy tube socks from Amazon. I mean, Amazon is a marketplace. I like to go to a bookstore for my books, so when I'm doing that online, I do it from bnn.com. But there are still some indies that are doing a great job out there, and I'm not quite as pessimistic about this as I was, say, 5 or 6 years ago.
So you mentioned that reading makes you a better person and a better citizen. Can you play that out a little bit about the better citizen piece?
Sure. When people are reading, the big lies of demagoguery fall. Because, you know, whether it's Senator Hoo-ha or, say, the host of a nightly show on a network named after an animal... They say, well, research shows that children do worse in gay families. And if you read enough, you say, no, no, the research doesn't show that at all. That's nonsense. So reading makes us better able, A, to be able to counter the big lies of demagoguery, and B, to be on the same plane with the decision makers in our country, so that when you had a system in which the king or the prime minister or the House of Lords and all that had all read all this stuff, but nobody they were overseeing had or could read, you had this uneven playing field. Today, it's remarkable to me how, for example, in town halls, ordinary citizens will be well enough informed that they'll ask really probing questions and follow-ups of elected officials about matters of national interest. So I think if we all keep reading, we have a better sense of whether our politicians are trying to sell us a bill of goods. Plus, if we read enough, and I'm going back to fiction now, about people who are different than we are. If you read The Bluest Eye, for example, by Toni Morrison, your ability to think of people of color as essentially different from you evaporates. And that promotes greater tolerance, and that promotes a better level of citizenship. So I think the extent to which reading tells us that we all have a lot in common promotes a more perfect union. Where am I?
The term chicklet. It always bothers me because it seems like it's denigrating women authors. I wondered if you would respond to that.
I think of chick lit as a kind of gum. I mean, come on, what does it mean? If you say, well, this book is chick lit because it's all about men in marriage, then you're talking about Pride and Prejudice. You know, don't, you know... Lily Bart, all she's interested in is who she's going to marry. Chick lit, the House of Mirth. It's just, you know, it's the same old deal with, like, somehow we have to be less. Well, if women are buying 85% of the hardcover books and my audience is only women, then I'm fine.
I'd like you to talk about Delaware County. Delaware County's produced you and Tina Fey right next door in Upper Darby. What is that about?
Wow. I never quite thought of it that way. I mean, look, I used to say the biggest impediment to me becoming a successful novelist is that I had a really happy childhood. And I did. And you know that old saw about how you go back to your old neighborhood and it's not what you remembered? It's exactly what I remembered. But I think I'm clearly a product of two things. One is I'm from a big, fractious Irish Catholic family. I'm also half Italian, and I'm very proud of that. But the Irish Catholic part is the part that would tell these long, involved, allegedly true stories, which seem to get bigger and more florid every year or with a few more Manhattans. And, I mean, storytelling seemed like, you know, everybody's in the living room leaning forward, listening to Bob telling the story. So it's like, this is a good gig. And the other thing is being Catholic. I mean, you know, being Catholic is, first of all, I'm a liberal because I'm a Catholic, because I believed all that stuff in the Sermon in the Mount. I really thought we were supposed to do that, you know. But it's also all about storytelling, you know, studying the New Testament, studying the Old Testament, the wedding feast at Cana, the loaves and fishes. It's like O. Henry with miracles. And I think those two things really combined to do whatever happened to me, whatever weird thing happened to me.
You wrote a fabulous novel, One True Thing, and then Hollywood bought the rights to the book. What was that experience like? Because you write a book, and it's your baby, and then you give it away to Hollywood, and they can do some really bad things with it. But it was a good movie, though.
You know what? When you finish a book, it's your baby. When you publish a book, it stops being your baby. Because what you realize is that author intention stops at the moment when a reader has a different thought. The bird flies. And for me, it's all the same where it goes. Because Hollywood can do some really good things, too, as we know. So I sold my book. Nobody put a gun to my head. I just cashed a check. I think writers are big babies about this. If you don't want them to change it at all, don't sell it, because they have to change it. It's a movie. You wrote a novel. What you hope is that the people involved will stay true to the spirit of what you were doing. And at every juncture, from the producer who originally optioned the book to the screenwriter who wrote the screenplay and who I may be working with again, to the actors, everybody was so clearly on that page that I didn't worry too much, and I thought the finished movie was superb. And that happened the two times that they made television movies out of my novels, too. I just feel very blessed that way, but I also feel like writers can be a little unrealistic about this whole deal.
I know you said that you would not go back to writing a column, but have you thought about something else along those lines for those of us who just love your commentary?
I'm working on a nonfiction book now, so there's some of that, and I do it from time to time. But I'm sort of feeling called to fiction nowadays. And I never say never about anything, but that seems to be the direction that I'm leaning pretty unequivocally. But thanks for liking the other stuff. Thank you very much. One more?
This may be off the subject a little bit, but what about the cable and network series that are taking over television? Do you watch any of them?
I watch all of them. I love television. I love television. I think some of the best writing out there is in television. Justified is so well written. Nurse Jackie is so well written. There's great writing. The Good Wife is so well written. Sherlock, oh, be still my heart. I loved those books when I was a little kid, and now to see them done in such an inventive way is just spectacular. So I think, you know, I respond to good writing whenever I wherever I find it. We were watching a bunch of Academy screeners over Christmas break, and we were maybe a half an hour into Nebraska. And I turned to my family and said, this is the best written movie that I've encountered in years. And I loved the acting, but the writing, It just was so good. So the whole idea that we're supposed to turn up our noses at television, it's preposterous. There's lots of really, really good stuff on television. My DVR is always full. So thank you. Let me just say one thing. So most of the time, I'm a woman on the fifth floor of a house in a little room with a blank computer screen thinking, is anybody going to read this stuff? And so when you go out in the world and there are readers, it's just an enormous thrill for people who do what I do. So thank you all very much for coming tonight.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.